right, we have one case on our 10:30 docket, Tranter versus Liss and Muller Company. If the clerk will please announce counsel who are arguing today. Thank you. All right, Ms. Block.
May it please the court. Good morning, Heidi Block on behalf of the appellant Tranter, Inc., and we are here challenging the trial court's denial of our request for a temporary injunction. We had sought a temporary injunction to prevent one of the appellees, Mr. Liss, the individual appellee, from violating a non-compete that he had signed with my client by going to work for one of Tranter's direct competitors, the other appellee, Paul Mueller Company. Tranter is a global engineering and manufacturing group. It designs, manufactures, and services heat exchangers. I'm not going to try to get into what heat exchangers are, but it's pretty technical. Paul Mueller, the appellee company, is a direct competitor of Tranter, and they're a competitor of Tranter's on a global level. They compete in the exact same markets. They produce almost the exact same products that do the exact same things for the exact same clients. So it really is a direct competitor of Tranter's. And Liss was employed with Tranter for 11 years, first as an inside sales tech and later as a regional sales manager, and he served all of the Western United States. And in that capacity, Liss trained and worked very closely with the manufacturer's representatives. He put together pricing. He worked directly with the customers. He trained and oversaw the sales reps. And the manufacturing representative network for Tranter is very critical to its success because that's how it gets its products to the customers. And in order to accomplish these tasks, Tranter provided Liss with critical confidential information and trade secrets, such as product specifications, engineering specifications, minimum gross profit margins, gross margin targets. He knew about their business goals and strategies. He knew about the pricing of their products when they were in a competitive bid situation. He knew which products were more profitable. And he also came to know intimate information about Tranter's customers. And that was critical because he knew what they wanted and how Tranter's products might be applied in their business, how it might be applied to a particular industry, because a heat exchanger might do different things in a biofuels industry versus some other kind of industry. And so he came to know that information. He knew about, Tranter's manufacturing representatives network. He was actually the one who was responsible for training and overseeing these manufacturer's representatives. He knew who was underperforming, who might be looking for another job. He knew who were its top sales reps and who was doing a good job. He knew about Tranter's costs. He knew about their key supplier base. I could go on, but it's really undisputed, I think, that he did get confidential information. In fact, Mr. List acknowledged that at the hearing, the temporary injunction hearing, that he did get confidential information in his employment. And when List first came to work for Tranter in 2001, he signed an employee technology agreement, and that contained both a confidentiality agreement and the covenant not to compete. Liss, under the confidentiality agreement, agreed not to disclose the confidential information and the trade secrets that he obtained while working and while performing his job responsibilities at Tranter. And under the covenant not to compete, he agreed for 3 years not to engage in any competitive work. Now, there was a clause in the covenant not to compete that might have allowed Liss to compete if Tranter consented, but Tranter did not consent. It did not give that consent because under its judgment, it was not provided clear and convincing evidence that he would not be using this confidential information in a competitive situation. And so once Tranter did not give its consent, that should have been the end of the discussion. And in fact, Paul Mueller indicated to Tranter that it would not employ Liss without our consent. Months later, we found out that they had done just that, and that's what prompted this lawsuit. Now, the trial court's ruling on a temporary injunction is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard, but it is an abuse of discretion to misapply the law.
In your original brief, or in the appellant's original brief, there was an argument that a de novo standard was applied to a review of the two findings that the court made in its order denying the temporary injunction. However, in your reply brief, you seem to have just gone with the abuse of discretion standard. Do you now agree it's just abuse of discretion standard?
It's mixed. I think ultimately, at bottom, it's an abuse of discretion standard. But because it is an abuse of discretion to misapply the law, and because the trial court made two legal determinations, I think this court needs to look at those legal determinations de novo as legal determinations. I mean, that's what courts do when it's looking at a legal determination on undisputed facts. So it's mixed, but I think ultimately, because the trial court made erroneous legal determinations on the undisputed facts, that constituted an abuse of discretion. So you still have to get to the abuse of discretion standard, but you get there by way of legal errors, because that's what the court did in this case. It made two legal errors. Now, under the... So the court did, in fact, do us a favor, I think. The trial court did do us a favor by telling us what the grounds were. The trial court refused to grant our temporary injunction request on two grounds. The court found and held that the covenant not to compete was unenforceable due to lack of consideration. And I think that's a legal question. It's mixed with the facts, and I'll get to the facts and how the facts relate to what should ultimately result in the legal conclusion from those undisputed facts. The second ground was that the court did not enforce the covenant not to compete because the covenant, under the court's view, did not contain a geographical limitation. So I want to address both of those. I'll talk about consideration first. A couple of important Supreme Court cases that I want to mention: Sheshinoff, of course, in 2006. That was the case that reconsidered the court's earlier decision in Light and said, look, when you have an at-will situation, that doesn't mean you can never have an enforceable non-compete. As long as an at-will's non-compete agreement, it becomes enforceable when the employer performs the promises that it made in exchange for that agreement. And a covenant, of course, must be ancillary to or part of an otherwise enforceable agreement. And an agreement to keep an employer's confidential information confidential and to not disclose the employer's trade secrets, that is an otherwise enforceable agreement that then in turn makes the covenant not to compete enforceable. And then in Mann Frankfurt several years later in 2009, the court addressed really the exact same situation that we have here, where when you're looking at the question of consideration, you have an agreement that requires the employee not to compete, requires the employee not to disclose confidential information, but you look at the face of the agreement and there's no express return promise by the employer to supply the information, the confidential information. So in previous cases, the court looked at that and said, well, there's no consideration there. It's only one way. The employee is making the promises. The employer is not making any return promises. And in Mann Frankfurt, the court looked at that very issue and said it's not fatal when the covenant not to compete does not contain an express promise by the employer, which is what we have here. There's no express promise by Tranter to supply Mr. List with confidential information. The Mann Frankfurt court said it's not fatal because that promise by the employer is implied as a matter of law. It's implied in the contract when the nature of the employment for which the employee is hired will reasonably require the employer to provide the confidential information for the employee to accomplish the contemplated job duties. And that's exactly what we have here. That implied promise is the consideration for the confidentiality agreement, which in turn is the ancillary agreement which makes the covenant not to compete enforceable. Now, the defendants argued that the holding in Mann Frankfurt is limited to cases involving accountants who have access to clients' confidential financial information and whose job can only be done without that confidential information. They focus on that only be done without the confidential information. But I challenge you to read the Mann Frankfurt decision and look for that language. It is not in there. That's not the test. Under the proper test as set forth in Mann Frankfurt, the facts of this case demonstrate that the job Liss was hired for initially in 2001 would reasonably require Tranter to provide him with the confidential information. And in 2001, when this agreement was signed, as I mentioned, he was hired initially as an internal sales tech. He helped to configure and design the products. He helped put together the quotes for both the gasketed and the welded plate heat exchanger. That's on page 134, 35 of the record. Page 72 of the record reveals that he worked inside the research and development lab. He worked side by side with the application engineers, side by side with the manufacturing engineers, side by side with the purchasing agents. He needed that confidential information and trade secrets about how these products are made in order to sell the products. He had to know how the products are made and in order to be able to go to a customer and say, this is going to work for what you need.
Well, of course, they say he didn't do the sales, that there were independent salesmen who did the sales. I mean,
He initially did sales. He initially was hired as an inside sales tech. He moved up to a regional sales manager where he was actually managing. But when we're looking at consideration, we have to look to see whether there was consideration in the first instance. And once there was, then the fact that he changed into a different position and was then subject to different confidential information, such as pricing and more strategic at a higher level, the agreement that he made in 2001 to keep all of the information confidential is still valid. So the fact that he needed that information and it was reasonable for Tranter to have supplied him that information in order for him to do his job, that's what gives you the implied promise by Tranter to supply him with the confidential information. So you have that implied promise, and then that promise is cemented when they, in fact, do supply him with the confidential information. And the record is certainly clear that they did just that. As I mentioned, Mr. Liss even acknowledges that he did receive confidential information and trade secrets during his employment. So on these undisputed facts, we believe as a matter of law, there was consideration for Liss's promise not to disclose the confidential information that Tranter gave to him and not to engage in any competitive work for 3 years. Excuse me. Now, I want to turn to the reformation unless there are any more questions on consideration. Reformation, that's the other big issue. Here's our complaint with the trial court. The trial court decided that there was no geographical limitation in the covenant not to compete, and it said, all I can do is deny the request for temporary injunction. And we submit to you that as a matter of law, that is wrong because it violates the statutory mandate for courts to reform a covenant not to compete if it believes there's an unreasonable time or geographic limitation.
You said previously that the trial court did you a favor by putting these two findings in the order. However, what the trial court was really doing was making an ultimate determination of the enforceability of the covenant not to compete, which isn't really the question in a temporary injunction hearing, is it?
You're absolutely right.
Of recovery.
You're absolutely right, but it goes hand in hand. And I think, as this court discussed in the Cobb versus K publishing decision, you sort of have to look at it. I mean, you're absolutely right. The court shouldn't be making an ultimate determination on the enforceability, but it did so in deciding whether or not we had a probable right of recovery, because in the trial court's mind, we didn't have a probable right of recovery because it was unenforceable, because there was no geographical limitation. And so working backwards from that, if you look at the statutory mandate, it requires courts to reform, not just deny the injunctive relief, but reform it. And that's a legislative mandate that mirrors the legislature's desire that we are going to enforce these restrictive covenants. If it has an unreasonable term, you don't just say that's the end of the discussion and deny it. The court is required to reform it. And I will acknowledge that there is a split of authority on this issue. There are some courts that say reformation should only happen at the ultimate judgment stage. This court, however, should follow its own precedent in the Cobb versus Kay decision, which is cited in our brief. And in that case, this court recognized that not only should the trial court have reformed what it, if it believed that there was an unreasonable geographic or time limitation. But on appeal, if the court didn't do so, then the Court of Appeals can do so. So I suggest that if you believe that the geographical limitation was too broad, you have not only the ability, but I submit to you the obligation under the statutory mandate to reform it and to reverse and you're still sending it back to the trial courts, so you're still remanding, but remand with instructions that it should be reformed. And if you look at Exhibit 6, that's a map of the United States, and in yellow are all the states where Mr. List performed work for Tranter, and with a pink check, there's a list of all the states where he has performed the exact same job duties for Paul Mueller, and there are 19 states that overlap. That testimony is undisputed, so we request that it be reformed, that the injunction be granted and be reformed if necessary to limit it to those 19 states. I'm out of time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Block. All right. Mr. Grimes, are you going first?
Yes.
Okay.
May it please the court and counsel. I'd like to mention at the outset that these facts are not undisputed. These are sharply contested. I think the briefs indicated that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time discussing that. I would like to point out, though, Ms. Block argued very well and mentioned that she wasn't going to get into how heat exchangers work because it was very technical. Tranter testified, List testified, Paul Mueller testified that heat exchangers work like radiators. They're fairly straightforward, and I don't say that to be nitpicky with Ms. Block or argumentative. But this is not the kind of situation where Liss was involved in super, super secret designs and then took it and went to a competitor. Scott Painish, vice president for Tranter, that testified on behalf of the company, had mentioned that these things are well known in the industry. Matter of fact, Tranter was able to service the competitors, people that compete with Tranter, competing companies, service their heat exchangers by taking them apart, reverse engineering them, and testified that it's a fairly straightforward matter. So again, that's not to be nitpicky, just to illustrate that he's not running off with any scientific information here. I wanted to discuss, again, the issues were briefed as far as the consideration and and some of the other items. Even if the court reforms them or sides with Tranter, it still has to examine, is there a threat of immediate irreparable harm? And in this case, there's not. Scott Painish never identified any immediate threat to Tranter. It's in the brief. Their lawyers have argued for it. But when Scott Painish was testifying, he admitted that, well, we really can't determine what's going on here. Said James List could cause all this stuff, all these bad things to happen because he knew about the pricing. Well, the pricing and the margins change every 6 months in Tranter. Saying that James List was hired as a sales tech and executed this agreement in 2001, had this confidential information, Painish testified that stuff changes every 6 months, sometimes even shorter time period. So whatever is confidential or even relevant in 2001, in January 2001, may be obsolete by June 2001, much less today. So again, Tranter said that he could cause all this harm, but we can't really be sure what it is. James List knows our margin targets, but Painish testified they change every 6 months. So I think they've changed at least 3 or 4 times as of today. It would be very difficult for Mr. List to continue harming the company based on margin figures he might have known then, which, by the way, he testified he was not privy to that information. He was classified as a high-level employee, but not privy to that high-level information. Tranter had also testified and argued that James List knows List can harm the company because he knows who the rep networks are. Those same reps are listed on Tranter's website. Tranter puts them out there so customers can see who they're dealing with, and this is not a matter of reps working in one room and being trained. These are networks. These are companies that provide sales reps. These reps, this outside network, might generate 1,000 to 1,200 quotes every single month. And James Liss's job as a sales manager when he was at Tranter, he might have reviewed on the high end 1 to 2% of them, according to his testimony. These weren't people he was seeing. He was not spending a lot of time with any of these reps. If they had questions, they could call him. Sometimes he might go out to meet with some of them, but this was not a case of direct supervision where Liss could come and say, hey guys, here's the good stuff. Here's how we're really gonna do it. It was a very, very arm's length working relationship with regard to James Liss and the Tranter outside rep network. And again, as far as the imminent harm goes, Tranter is arguing here that really they shouldn't have to demonstrate any harm to this court other than saying this is really, really bad and he has all this stuff. Again, in our brief, we have contested most of the issues or most of the facts that Tranter said was confidential. Painish testified that pretty much anything somebody receives while they're at Tranter was confidential. Matter of fact, the only thing he testified that was not confidential were vendor market studies, where they hired outside vendors to provide these market studies for him, which really is the most confidential sounding bit of information. James Liss and the other outside sales reps put together their own list, their own training, and he said a lot of it was just looking for training materials on websites, not stuff provided to him by Tranter.
So there's no confidential scientific or engineering type information involved. It's more marketing, financial information.
Ultimately, James Liss was a marketing and sales manager. Now, being in a technical business, and there's going to be some argument over what constitutes confidential. Heat exchangers have been around. Again, the easiest way to think of these things, it operates like a radiator. On one side, it removes heat from an object and cools it down. They've been around for decades. So in that regard, there is technical information, yes. They deal in the technical information. Is it confidential? Does Tranter have information that they rely on that James Liss has to know to do his job that's proprietary to them? Not necessarily. Again, he's at a very, very high level. He's not an engineer. He doesn't have an engineering degree. He never put these in. And as far as working side by side and producing quotes based on customer specifications, this all happens through a computer. He gets specifications, or the reps get specifications from their customers with their list of requirement. He inputs them in the computer. The computer spits them out. And at that point, Liss was able to help either suggest an alternative. He could go back to the reps if they needed help, maybe an alternative person to talk to or something like this. But as far as design, he did not design any of these things. The computer designs them for him. He wasn't privy to that knowledge. I hope that was a decent answer to the question. If there are no more questions, I'll yield my time to Mr. Key.
All right.
I think I'm out anyway, so.
Thank you, Mr. Grimes. Mr. Key.
May it please the court. I think that one of the key things to keep in mind in this case is the standard of review. This is an abuse of discretion, and the court must affirm the ruling of the trial court if there is any legal theory supported in the record upon which it can affirm the trial court's ruling. Tranter seems to take the position that a party seeking to enforce a restrictive covenant need merely plead the restrictive covenant and offer some proof in support of the requisite elements for their cause of action. And at that point, trial court is just required to grant a temporary injunction. But the common rules that apply to all injunctive relief apply to these cases, and Tranter must show a probable likelihood of success in the merits. And I think the court's right in seizing upon the fact that the findings reciting in the order are really, I don't want to say immaterial, but they certainly aren't binding on this court, are not going to limit this court's examination of the record or how this appeal goes. I would suggest that there's really three reasons why the court was properly denying the temporary injunction. One was that it was not supported by consideration. Then this goes to Mann Frankfurt and whether or not this type of job was one where we will make an exception and imply consideration into an agreement where it doesn't recite express consideration. I think that the law is that is an exception to the Light and Sheshinoff line, not that is overruling it and saying we're going to imply it in every case. I think the state of the law on this is that when the facts show that confidential information is the essence of the job, is intimately required to do the job, then it's fair to imply that, even if the parties didn't expressly state that. But this is not that type of case. Now, another reason is that the agreement was not enforceable without reformation. Now, I think this has been accurately addressed by counsel, in that there is a split among the courts of appeals. Do we reform at this stage, or do we reform at final judgment? And I know that the court has previously directed the trial courts to do the reformation at the injunctive stage, but I don't think we've had enough discussion here today for the court to do that. I wouldn't know how you guys would hope to come up with some type of reformation if you thought that was in fact required just on the basis of the record in our discussions here today. I think the better ruling is to reform it at final judgment if the agreement needs to be reformed. But the most important reason that the trial court's judgment should be affirmed is that the agreement was not enforceable under its own terms because Liss and Mueller have done everything required in order to be entitled to obtain Tranter's consent to Liss's future employment. And this is why this case is not going to be in the line of the Mann Frankfurt case ultimately, because this contract has a provision that I've never seen anywhere else. It's much more favorable to the employee than your standard boilerplate restrictive non-competition agreement. So, of course, there are no cases out there on that, but I think that's going to be what decides this case. The record was undisputed. Scott Painish testified that there was nothing else that we needed to provide him in order to give the consent. He simply didn't believe us, wasn't going to believe us, and thought it would put his company at a competitive disadvantage to allow Mr. Liss to take the new job. But
so by your interpretation of that favorable clause, all an employee has to do is to say, I'm not going to do it, and that former employer is supposed to believe you, and you get to go work wherever you want. So what's the point of a covenant?
That's not all he has to do. He's got to be in a factual situation where that is believable. And it is believable in this case because, at best, Mr. List was exposed to confidential information. Confidential information was not in his tool belt. It wasn't something that he needed to do his job. Mr. Painish testified about how, in using their proprietary software program, which he doesn't have, doesn't take with him, and wouldn't do him any good anyway because Mueller has its own proprietary software system, if he'd wanted to, he could have gone back in and examined the cost information. Well, he doesn't have any evidence that he actually did that, but he's saying he could have. He was exposed to it. And that simply is not a sufficient basis to say that he's going to use that confidential information against Tranter, because factually there's just no way that he can use it against him. The nature of this business is such that information turns over rather quickly. But the more important thing is that each company has its own manufacturing process. When a customer puts out bids, say we got a request for proposal, we need a heat transfer system that'll do X, Y, and Z. Give us proposals. Mueller can only work with the equipment they have. They have certain lines of products with certain specifications. Same for Tranter. They've got their own products, their own specification. The best you can do is to try to cut your bid as low as you can, and that's true no matter what the information underlying it is. It's simply a question of how cheap can you make your product, how effective can you make your product fit into their system. And your knowledge of your competitor's product isn't going to help you make your product fit into their system any better or any cheaper. The facts are just such that the confidential information he was exposed to simply isn't going to be a benefit to them in his new job, and it's merely a pretext for denying him the opportunity to compete against Tranter. And the agreement specifically says that we're not going to prevent you from working in the heat transfer industry generally, but that's exactly what they're trying to do in application. They will not consent to it simply because he competes with them. It's not that he's unfairly competing and using confidential information. It's that he competes with them at all.
Was we don't believe you.
Right. So that's what he said at trial, but he also said his real emphasis was that it was the same job, the same region, and he's going to compete with us. I mean, if you go back and you read Painish's testimony, he says it over and over again, same job, same region, he's competing with us. That's the root of their complaint. Not that he's taking their confidential information and using it against them, but that he's competing against them. And their agreement says you can compete against them. We will consent to it, just don't use our confidential information against us. That's the agreement the parties wrote.
As if you provide clear and convincing evidence.
And they have.
Well, that's for somebody to decide credibility of that.
And Judge Brotherton decided that, and unless he abused his discretion in deciding that, you don't have any basis to overturn his ruling on that in this case. We get
for
the benefit
to assume that he decided that, even though he didn't include that as one of his findings.
That's absolutely right. We do have to assume that. Real nub of the case, judges. I mean, the standard of review goes in our benefit. We get every benefit of the doubt on this, and I don't see any way, based upon this record, that the court could hold that the trial court abused its discretion in denying the temporary injunction.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Key. Ms. Block, rebuttal.
Ms. Block, could you?
Yes, I'm sorry.
In your concluding remarks, could you comment on the irreparable harm element, please?
Certainly. Let me start, though, by suggesting I think we have at least one or two former trial judges on the bench. Trial courts, if they're going to deny an injunction, they're going to list every reason why they think it should be denied, and the trial court didn't do that here. So we only have to look at the two. Now, if they want to establish that there was, and it's their burden to show that there was an alternative ground for affirming it, they're free to raise those issues, and they did in their brief, but they haven't met their burden to show that those alternative grounds exist. Irreparable harm, let me get right to that. They argue in their brief that we didn't show harm, that we didn't prove harm, but that wasn't our burden. Our burden under a temporary injunction standard was only to show a probable immediate and irreparable injury and a probable right of recovery. And I want to mention the it's an unpublished opinion, but Heritage Operating versus Rhine Brothers from this court, in fact, Justice Gabriel, you wrote that opinion just a year ago in June of 2012. This court held that a party seeking injunctive relief under the Covenants Not to Compete Act does not have to show irreparable injury for which there's no adequate remedy as a prerequisite to injunctive relief, because that statute does allow the court to grant injunctive relief or damages or both. So that's the authority for the injunctive relief. But in any event, again, all we needed to show was a probable irreparable injury, and the evidence in the record demonstrates that. Mr. Painish testified that with the information that List took with him to his new job, and whether he was intentionally using it, it had become organic. After 11 years of being exposed to this confidential information, it was part of him. It was in his tool belt, whether he wants it to be in there or not. It became part of how he did his job as a sales managing sales rep. Mr. Painish testified that because of that knowledge, its direct competitor could start underbidding it in jobs. Tranter would lose business. List is in the exact same job, the same position, the same products, the same markets as Tranter. There'd be irreparable harm by moving some customers away from Tranter to Paul Mueller. It could reduce harm revenues. It could reduce this harm the stakeholders in the company. So there is testimony indicating that there was the threat, the probable likelihood of irreparable harm. And Mr. Painish did say that it was impossible to determine, to quantify that harm, but that's what gives you the inadequate remedy at law. So the fact that he can't quantify it doesn't defeat the existence of the probable harm. So there was that probable harm, although I suggest to you, you don't even need to get that because we're dealing with a breach of contract. We're not just dealing with a common law claim for violating someone's trade secrets where you would have to show that there was a real threat of the trade secrets being taken and being used. We have a contract. We have a contract where Mr. Liss agreed not to go work for a competitor in a situation where he might be using his confidential information. And I suggest to you that, and this really goes to the consent issue too, it was subjective from Tranter's standpoint. They were not clearly convinced of the information that was provided under the request for consent. And I suggest to you that it's really, I think, impossible, certainly unreasonable to think that after 11 years of getting confidential information and using it on a daily basis in his job with Tranter, that he wouldn't have access to that information and use it in his new job at Paul Mueller.
And there was nothing in the agreement, though, that gave any kind of remedy in regard to failure to give consent, was there? In other words, it was just the an ordinary contract duty of reasonable and good faith.
Well, you often see contracts that say, and consent shall not be unreasonably withheld, but we don't even have that here. And, you know, I agree with counsel who said this is an unusual situation. It was very favorable to the employee. But it gave us the right to grant consent or not. And it gave us the right to determine whether we were clearly convinced by the evidence, and we were not. And again, I suggest to you that someone in the exact same position, working with the exact same products in the exact same markets with the exact same customers, it is just near impossible to think that he wouldn't be using that information. And it's not even just use. If you look at the covenant, on the consent provision, it says, the employee will be permitted to engage in the work described above if I provide Tranter with clear and convincing evidence that the contribution of my knowledge to the new work will not cause me to disclose, use, or base judgment upon any of the confidential information that I got while I was at Tranter. Base judgment upon. So he can't even think, he can't even base his judgment in his new position on information, confidential information that he got while at Tranter. And I think that's important. And that was the reason, one of the significant reasons why we denied consent. A couple more bullet points on the question of whether the facts are undisputed. Certainly there are disputed facts in the record. But on the critical ones, on the material ones, there's no dispute. There's no dispute, for example, that Liss did get confidential information. There's no dispute that his job was such that it reasonably required Tranter to provide him with confidential information in order to accomplish that job, and that goes to the consideration. I want to talk briefly about the timing. Council mentioned the timing and the cycle, the sales cycle. The testimony by Mr. Panish was that there was a 1 to 2 year sales cycle, but if you look at that testimony on page 102 and 104 of the record, he testified that the threat is greatest at the 1 to 2 year cycle, and then it begins to diminish after that. So because of that testimony, the 3 year limitation was certainly a reasonable one in this situation. And then also speaking of time, non-competes are often very critically time sensitive. I'm out of time. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Block. And Mr. Grimes and Mr. Key, we appreciate your arguments and all the briefing submitted on this matter. Your case is submitted, and you all are now excused, and we will adjourn court.
Everyone, please rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District.